Welcome to the Backend Engineering Show with your host, Hussein Nasser. This is the show where we discuss the art and the craft of building software and cover recent news on backend technologies. If you enjoy the show, make sure to subscribe to the YouTube channel and rate it on Spotify and Apple Podcasts. With that said, let's get on the show. Guys, doing? I love this song. Let it finish. Awesome. How's everybody doing? How is everybody doing this fun Saturday? And can you guys hear me? Let's get this show started. All right, how about we start this show? Okay, which one is this? Yeah, this one. Ah, it's so bright. I need to get a better camera. All right, let's fix this thing. Sorry about the mess, guys.
We just started.
We're gonna about start. All right, so welcome to the Backend Engineering Show, guys. This is episode number 8. I started labeling those episodes now because, I don't know. Here's what I want to do. I start with labeling them, and then after the show, and after your great questions, I start changing the title to reflect what's the content. You know the meme? Like this? That meme. How is everybody doing? Rami, good to see you. Adarsh, what up? What is quick? We're going to find out. Maybe we'll never reach that topic because there's a lot of stuff we need to discuss before we discuss quick. But it's a communication protocol. Just bit my tongue. Nasty Wicked, welcome to the stream. Man, morning allergies are the worst. Especially in this weather. So it takes me like 2 hours to get straight up. Rishab. Love your videos, Hussein. Thank you so much. What do you think of Codility? Codility. I don't know what that is. Pretty sure if it's useful and people using it, why not? Happy December. Jetton. Yeah, so what I want to do in this show today, guys, we're going to open it up for questions and casual questions about any communication protocol, but I want to prepare. This show is a preparation for the quick video, and quick doesn't stand for anything. It used to be standing for the quick UDP intercommunication, but they said no, it's not an acronym for anything. It's just called quick. Don't overthink it. Which, well, I was like, oh, really? That sucks. We talked about Celery a little bit. I mean, the DoorDash video when they moved from RabbitMQ to Kafka. Abdul Rashid. We talked about it, and they were using Celery, and they were getting all these problems, but we still don't know what caused those problems. I had a lot of questions, so we don't know, right? Maybe it could be Celery. I had a lot of doubts, and people in the comment also said that it could have been a misconfigured Celery configuration, or just that use case just doesn't work for that DoorDash's scenarios. What else? So we're going to discuss quick. So a quick, guys, is the protocol that have been invented to solve certain problems. Everything in backend engineering, everything in software engineering is always invented to solve a problem. I have a lot of trouble when I see a technology that doesn't solve a problem just because it's cool or just, hey, it's a modern technology. I don't buy that, right? If you're gonna buy, if you're gonna build a new technology and everybody who are on the top agree with this statement, you know, move to a new technology, it has to give you a lot of feedback, a lot of performance, a lot of good stuff. And not just new features that you actually can benefit from. Right? So Quick actually delivers. Do you have any good way of using WebRTC with multiple peers except mesh design? I thought about that the other day. WebRTC. So we're going to do a little bit of Q&A before we start the show. And then we're going to jump into the progression of Quick. But this is a good question. Let's take that one. So Maya Nak says, do you have any good way of using WebRTC for multiple peers? So WebRTC is designed to be a peer-to-peer architecture. So that means you have two parties and they communicate directly. Directly. Let me say this again. Directly. There are no server that turns the traffic. There is no centralized server. Okay. Yeah, there are nodes in the internet that delivers that traffic, but those are silent nodes. Just like you and I are, I'm producing this stream and you guys are listening. There are packets that are streamed across all the internet and they're going through boxes and they check the IP and say, oh, this is going to this, let's go to this direction IP. And then it just does the IP routing and goes through all that stuff. So WebRTC was designed to be peer-to-peer. So the question is, the moment I scale WebRTC to many, many, many participants, then it becomes a mesh, right? Because user A and user B and user C, let's use actual names, right? Ali and then Rick and then Paul and then Muhammad and then Adarsh and then Raj and then Dave. All of these people need to communicate with each other. I forgot the names already. So Ali need to communicate with Dave. Dave need to communicate with Rick. Rick need to communicate with Adarsh. All of a sudden, you have a peer-to-peer with every single one of them. How do you do the math, this one? All right, so N times N minus 1. Is that how you do it? This many connections. So it's just like doubles, exponential. Not that bad. Couldn't be that bad. Right, but yeah, you will have as a client, you have to communicate, establish connections with everybody, and then everybody has to establish a connection with everybody as a peer-to-peer connection, and that just does not scale. That's the problem with WebRTC, right? So clever people, what they did, Discord did that actually. Check out my Discord video with their WebRTC. They used another peer. So they communicate a server as a peer, which is very clever. So you, as a client, connect to the server, but that server is just a peer now. But everybody communicates to the server as a peer-to-peer connection, right? But they only have one connection. And now the server acts like a server and then distributes the traffic. So you might say, what the heck? This is just a normal centralized server location. Yeah, exactly. We turned WebRTC into this mode in order to scale, right? Because peer-to-peer is not scalable. And then if you do that, you might say, what's the advantage? Why don't I use just normal stuff? Well, the WebRTC comes with a lot of nice APIs and nice things that allows you to scale, right? It allows you to get the user media, allows you to do stun and turn. I made a video about WebRTC. Check out the details if you want to know that. Coding Brian says, do you also do backend? Was the first tech job? Oh, what was the question for me? I only do backend in this channel most of the time, I guess. My first job was a software engineer to build a, what is it? To build the GIS solutions. So I was a geographic information system engineer for a long time, analyst. GIS developer, let's call it that. So a GIS developer. So we built solutions to enable geographic applications, such as, and my specialties was utilities, so electric and water. So answering network questions, right? So it's like, what is the closest point from me as a customer to the closest transformer? That's a network. And GIS has a lot of play with this, with the networking solution. So I play with the databases all the time. My first job has nothing to do with web. Was always a client server, so desktop thick applications. But if you think, if you translate this today, it's all backend, right? Do you think graph databases could have a future? Of course, graph has a very specific use case, and I think it's very useful to solve certain solutions, certain cases. How's everybody doing? I would like to welcome all the new subscribers. Man, November was a great month for the channel. We saw a lot of growth. We've seen a lot of new people, a lot of new blood, a lot of new contribution to the channel. Like the comments and the discussions are fantastic. And unfortunately, I can no longer catch up with the comments anymore. There are just a lot of comments. So I apologize. I read most of your comments. I try to get all of them, but I apologize if you don't know. Nitzan, hey, from Israel. Hello, Nitzan. Okay. Where do you work now? I work in a company called ESRI, Environmental Research. I forgot the name. Environmental Systems and Research Institute, ESRI. And I still do GIS to this day. That's my day job. Lots of books sitting behind you. Any good one that you would like to recommend? Yeah, of course. Sorry about that. Let me blow my nose a little bit. This allergy, man. So yeah, a lot of people ask me about my books that I have here. Most of the time, I mean, my software engineering knowledge, if I want to dive deep into the actual topic, right, there is like a topic that I need to understand, like, I don't know, Linux, I will buy a book, right? But most of the stuff that doesn't have books, like the new stuff, right, service mesh and quick protocol, communication protocol, there's no book that tells you all of that stuff. But there's actually something better, which is the RFC, the request for comments. This gives you a lot of great knowledge, but it's very, very hard to read those RFCs. And so the books I recommend here is really most of them nothing to do with software engineering. I would recommend reading outside software engineering and take that knowledge and apply it there. But definitely the classic books, right? Design Pattern, it just makes you, when it comes to coding, that makes you then Pragmatic Programmer, that's a good book. What else? And there are some of them I can't really call now, but yeah. I'll make a video discussing this topic, really, about the books and all that stuff. Good morning, Otto. Good morning to you. Okay, it's probably evening for you guys. So yeah. So let's start the show, guys. So quick, in order to talk about quick, guys, we need to understand why it was invented. And we will go all the way back. And I have actually an outline here to discuss all that stuff, right? The outline, we're going to start with, what's the problem with HTTP 1.0? So HTTP was designed to be a request response system where on top of TCP. So that means if I am a client and I'm connecting to a server to consume a web page, right? We're going to establish a TCP connection, and that's a SYN, SYNACK, and then ACK. That's the first thing. Then after that, we're going to send a request. The client always makes the initiative here and then sends a request to get a specific resource, and then that server will try to understand that request. Very important, this step, because a request is nothing but a bunch of TCP segments, right? Broken into TCP segments because requests can get large. And then once the server assembles all these packets and understand, oh, you want to do a GET request, oh, you want to do a POST request, it will deliver this packet to the application and then gets the file or gets the API or gets anything and then responds back with the actual content. So that's HTTP 1.1, and that's the on top of TCP, right? All of a sudden, when the web blew up, we have not just one resource. We have many resources. We have a page with lots of images, lots of CSS files, lots of JavaScript files. And all of a sudden, we want to send multiple requests on the same TCP connection. There's a problem with that. We're going to come to that later. But we couldn't do that. We couldn't send multiple requests at the same time in the same TCP connection, right? It says, hey, give me that JavaScript and give me that CSS, right? We had to wait. We send a request and we wait. We get a response and then, oh, now I can send another request. So that obviously that slows things down. So people, smart people say, okay, since we can't send two requests on the same TCP connection, how about we just open another TCP connection? So all of a sudden, we started opening multiple TCP connection, 2, 3, 4, 5, up to 6, I believe. That's the Chrome default for that domain. And now we can multiplex, quote unquote, multiplex request into all of these connections so that we can simulate parallelism so that we can get faster thing. You might say, Hussein, as a developer, I've never had to do with any of that stuff. I just go and do a fetch, or my JavaScript just does a multiple request. Yeah, because the HTTP library in the browser for HTTP 1.1 takes care of that for you. It takes care for being stateless. It takes care of being all of that stuff. It opens all the TCP connections. So that's why I always tell front-end engineer and back-end engineer, when you write code, understand what are you doing. Understand the underlying protocol, because you might hit a performance thing that you have nothing to do with, but if you actually understand it, that will make you a better software engineer, whether front-end or back-end, right? Because now you understand, because if you explain to someone, oh, I sent a lot of requests and I didn't get any delays, but the seventh request is delayed. Why? To your code. Your code looks good. There's no problem with your code. You're sending many requests at the same time. But once you understand this limitation, you say, ah, that's why. So this is obviously a hack. Some people said, okay, we really need to fix this one TCP, one request connection, right? We need to send multiple requests in the same TCP connection and get responses. She says, okay, we can do that. TCP have this concept of sequencing, right? Each packet you send is labeled with a sequence number. We talked about TCP, guys. Check it out here. I'm not going to add a card right now, but just type TCP handshake Hussein in the post-production. Hopefully I remember to add. So 28, I'm going to add a card there. So we add these sequences. So every packet you send is labeled sequentially. So now if you theoretically send three requests, and let's assume for simplicity's reasons, a GET request fits nicely into one TCP packet or segment. Auto, do they call it TCP segment or TCP packet? I always confuse the two, right? Auto is a genius network engineer. He always corrects me when I say something stupid. So yeah, I don't know if it's called segment or packet. So correct me if that. I'm going to say segment. But let's say it's just one TCP segment, one to one, right? So that means the first request it gets sequence number, I don't know, 100. This is 100 and whatever the length, 110. And then this is 120. I'm assuming the packet length is 10 bytes. So 1, 100, 110, 120. So if you send it this way, if the server can actually, as long as the server responds in the same order, you're good. So that means if the server responds, the first response must go to the request number one. The second response goes to request number two, and the third response goes to request number three. It has to be in order. If you can guarantee that, we can do multiplexing in HTTP 1.1, and we're gonna call this HTTP pipelining, HTTP pipelining. Okay. Adita says TCP segment and IP packets. Thank you. That's what the confusing things are. So it's called TCP segment for the TCP layer and a packet for the IP layer. Thank you. مقداد أسعدك الله مساءك يا أخي ناصر. Thank you so much. Welcome to the stream. So HTTP pipeline, that's what we have. We have HTTP pipelining. And we said, we don't need to open multiple TCP connections anymore. This is, wait a second. You're telling me if I send five requests and the server receives them in order, request number one, two, up to five, what if request five happen to process faster? I don't know. It's a CSS file that is small, while request number one is a query to the database and it takes longer time. How can the server guarantees that request number one goes first? Request number five finished. Sorry, request number five has to wait. Request number four has to wait. Request number three has to wait. Request number two has to wait until request number one finished processing. So that is called head of line blocking. And we're going to see it. This is the major problem in HTTP. And HTTP 2.2 has the same problem. 2.2. HTTP 2 has the same problem. And Quick also has the same problem, but it solves most of this stuff. So that's the limitation that we have. Is TCP and IP same layer? No. TCP is layer 4, IP is layer 3. But sometimes they call it TCP/IP because they merge this thing. And when I, as a backend engineer, say layer 4, I mean both of them, usually. All right. To a network engineer, if you say this, they're going to laugh at you because I get a lot of network engineers yelling at me all the time. So I try to give my terminology straight all the time. All right. So that's the HTTP pipeline. That's the first problem, head of line blocking. The second problem is with HTTP pipeline and why nobody uses it anymore is proxies. So now insert a layer 7 proxies in the middle, that Nginx, HAProxy, Caddy, with HTTP 1.1. We're still talking about HTTP 1.1. That's why I have no idea we're going to reach Quick or talk about Quick in this channel. But I wanted to talk about the problems. Why do we invent new things? And we need to drill this into our head that everything has a reason. We invent things for a reason. We don't just for fun of it to invent new things, right? So HTTP 1.1 has this problem with HTTP pipelining. Okay, we said, sure, I'll handle the HTTP, the head of line blocking. It's not nice, but I don't know what to do. Let's keep it. All right. So HTTP, another thing is HTTP pipelining. There are many problems because you're sending multiple requests from the request side, from the client side. There are also a problem. I talked about the head of line blocking in the response side, where the REST server cannot respond for later requests until the earlier request actually finishes because order, right? We want order. Otherwise, how would we know, right? So there's another problem in HTTP pipelining with the request itself, which is ahead of line blocking at the request level. Let's talk about that. So now if I send multiple requests, five requests, I don't know why I'm doing that. I want an empty space so I can wave my hand maybe here. So if I'm sending multiple requests and request number 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, these also are in order. So the server will not process, when I say process, understand here, will not understand request number 5 until request number 1 actually finish processing. So if you have a lot of headers in request number 1 or a lot of stuff in request number 2, that then these the earlier ones has to wait. If there is a single packet that was lost in request number 1 and need to be retransmitted, that's a feature in TCP retransmission, the sequence numbers are says, oh wait a second, you're giving me sequence number 300, but I didn't receive sequence number 200. There's something missing in this chain. I'm going to block you, son. I cannot process any other request. I cannot understand what you're saying to me as a client. These are, to me, they are dump segments. Thank you. They are dump segments, not packets. They're just dump segments. I don't understand. I cannot combine them to understand them, right? So I have to wait for earlier segments to actually finish process, to finish delivering, in order for you to just understand the request. That this is, oh, this is a GET request with this header cookie, and this is a POST request with this, and this is a head request, and this is another POST request, and this is a PUT request. Just to understand that, just for the server to understand that, not process them, not actually go to the disk and pull the index or query the database, just to actually deliver that, oh, there was a request. Order also has to be applied, and that's another head of line blocking. So two head of line blocking problem, at the response level and at the request level. That is very, very critical to understand. That's just slow. That's why we invented HTTP2 and streaming. We wanted to pipe those into multiple things, which we're going to understand that it didn't really help much. So HTTP, the third problem with HTTP pipelining, so three problems, is proxies. If you insert a proxy in the middle, like Nginx or HAProxy or Caddy or Envoy or any of those fancy reverse proxies, then the proxy, if they support pipelining, they have to guarantee this order thing, right? Because if I send 5 requests, what do we say in pipelining? You better give me the responses in the same order. How would Nginx know the order? It's very, very difficult. Even if they could, it will have to be very, very buggy implementation, right? Because now request number 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 was received in the same stream of segments, right? Now we turn around and we send the request to the backend, right? Because that's what the reverse proxy do. It talks on your behalf. So that also, look, like the Nginx has to do, okay, oh, I sent request number 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Let me send it in the same order, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And if the server responds with 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, the reverse the Nginx has to remember that, oh, I have to actually send these in the same order. And that's very, very hard to get right. So it's tough. Pipelining. So nobody now does do any pipelining. Sip of water. Take a break. So we talked about HTTP 1.1. We talked about the problem with HTTP 1.1. We talked about the solutions that we try to do. Like, hey, pipelining. Another solution with HTTP 1.1. Oh my God, what the heck? I wave my hands a lot. So another problem with HTTP 1.1, or let's say workarounds or hacks, is, okay, all right, as a client, as a browser, you're telling me I cannot send multiple requests in the same TCP connection. Okay, I'm going to open multiple TCP connections, as we explained earlier. But I have 6. I have only 6. That's why, by the way, server-side, server-sent events is terrible when it comes to HTTP 1.1 because of this limit. It just hooks that connection, right? Server-sent event. Once you send a request and the server starts streaming response on the same TCP connection, this connection is done, son. I like that it rhymed. This connection is done, son. Because you cannot use it for anything else. That's the rule of HTTP 1.1, because we talked about, right? HTTP pipelining is just bad, right? Couldn't fix it. So here's one TCP connection down the drain. I cannot do anything with that one. So what should I do? Well, open another TCP connection. Or if you do another request that takes a long time, then because that's what SSE is, right? It's just a long request. If you think about it, it's just a request that takes a long time to process, just like partial results in 206 status code. So it's easy to fill up these six TCP connections. So people said, okay, let's do some clever things. Let's do domain sharding. Domain sharding is a fancy word for splitting the domains into just create another domain that points to the same IP address and do SNI, which is server name indication, to essentially identify which domain you're requesting. And I'm talking about TLS in this case. So now all of a sudden, if I have two domains to the same IP address, to the same server, essentially, hey, I can open 12 TCP connections. Why is Chrome taking this much memory? That is why, son. That is why. All these TCP connections. Vibhav, love your explanation, sir. Thank you. Thank you so much, guys. Thank you for all the love. Thank you for all the love, guys. Thank you for all the love. I appreciate you. So, yeah. Yes. Yes. So we have this problem, right? We have this problem with pipelining. We have this problem with, they started doing all this stuff. Another trick they did, okay. They said, let's do something more clever. We have multiple resources. You Dumbo do not have multiple resources, right? That's the browsers telling the webmasters. It's, why are you having 600 JavaScript files? Just combine them all into one, so that we can make one request instead of 700 requests to pull these, which sounds enticing, right? It's just a good idea to combine things instead of breaking them down, right? It's just less stuff to request, right? So people started combining images together. I forgot what the word is called. Like let's say you have a flag. Like you want to store all the flags on your web server, right? Of how many countries in the world. So instead of having this much country, this is embarrassing. I don't know how many countries there are. It's like, how many countries in the world? Yeah, I'm this dumb, guys. 195. I apparently didn't take any of this. The funny part is that my specialty is geographic information system, guys. Just take a second to think about that, because someone who's in the GIS sector doesn't know how many countries in the world. Yeah, I'm that dumb. So 195 images of flags, what, that's not a word, flags, 195 images, can I say it this in French, son neuf quatre-vingt-dix cinq, I think, 195. That's the only French I studied back in high school. I still remember. Tariq Ali. Yes, I'm early. A little bit early. That's the only time I have. And Saturday is very hard. It's very hard to find some time on Saturdays. So, sorry about that. I still have some allergies. Morning allergies. So, what we're talking about? 195 flags. So, if you're actually requesting 195 requests, that's 195 requests. If you're doing it in parallel, the six connections can not possibly handle that stuff for you. So people said, okay, let's create one big image and put all the flags in it, and then let the client parses the flags and then extract what flags they want. So you make one request. So that's kind of clever. And so what else? So that these are the hacks that we used to do with HTTP 1.1 before HTTP 2 came into the story and solved most of this stuff. I think this is enough talking about HTTP 1. No, HTTP 1.1. There is one big problem with HTTP 1.1. We didn't talk about compression. Header compression. Let's talk about header compression. There is an attack called CRIME. Let me say what stands for. CRIME Wiki. CRIME stands for... I don't think it stands for anything. Jesus, that's not the right wiki. CRIME attack. Talk me to a crime. Okay, CRIME with a capital. So let me put this wacky. Wacky. Compression ratio info leak made easy. You know what I remember? I don't know if you guys watched The Office. It was like a crime. Crime. I forget what it was like. Crime reduces innocence, makes everyone guilty, I declare. I forget what it was like. Crime aid. Crime aid. That was like funny. This read exactly like that. Compression ratio info leak made easy. Crime reduces innocence, made. I declare. So crime, I sent that crime thing. So this is a compression attack. So let's talk about why do we compress? Why do we compress? Headers, guys. HTTP headers. Those cookies, those dang cookies that you guys sent, that the front-end engineer sent, all these cookies and JWTs and all this stuff that you guys do, right? I blame you. I'm doing the same thing. But all those cookies, guys, are huge, and there's like many headers. So since all of them are actually repetitive, some people say, sure, HTTP 1.1, let's just compress this stuff. Let's just compress this stuff and say, hey, what we're going to do is we're going to start compressing the request, only the headers portion, before we send it. Just that, because we're going to minimize it. Because if you compress, that means there's a chances that you're going to fit in a fewer TCP segments. And as a result, if you fit in this fewer TCP segments, that's awesome, isn't it? Yeah. So if you fit this thing in list TCP segments, that means there are fewer round trips, which is awesome. So we started compressing, and we were so happy about that. And securing. So we have TLS security, and we have compression as well. So this is great. We said, that's awesome. Let's compress. But someone, a researcher said, compression. How does compression work, guys? If you have a bunch of stuff that are the same, right? If you have A, 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 B, 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 then it comes A7 or B3, right? If you have a lot of repetitive things, then the compressing algorithm will try to compact it into a fewer things. So it fits essentially less space, right? So that's a very simplistic explanation of compression. This researcher who discovered this crime attack, man, what he did is says, okay, the headers contain cookies, which contains beautiful tokens, right? Which contains sometimes credential or token or API or token access stuff, right? All of this is okay because they are secure. So nobody in the middle sniffing can actually know any of that stuff, right? You cannot know because it's encrypted. You cannot really decrypt it to look at the content, right? So what do we do? Look what he did. So let's say your password or not password. Let's say your access token is called tree. I don't know, just a word here. I'm simplifying it. But if I compress this, the header, the request, will become smaller, right? If I manage to compress it. But if I don't compress it, it's going to become this certain size. So what he did is says, okay, what if I sent you a URL, this evil URL, and in that URL, I am going to make a request to Facebook.com, which you already logged in, and your access token is 3, right? That's your access token. And I don't know it as an attacker. But the fact by you visiting my site, that will make a request to Facebook.com as long, and since the same site attribute is set to none, let's assume, that will send the cookie, and that will send that access token, right? So now I know that this is 3. That's the access token. So if I look at the middle as an attacker, I have access to the, let's say I am the ISP, or I am in the route to Facebook.com. Oh, I just picked up the packet. It's encrypted. I cannot see anything. But I know the size of the packet. So let's say the size is 100 after compression. So I have the luxury in my evil side to pad the headers with other arbitrary stuff. So if I padded the letter T, right, in the headers while sending the request to Facebook.com, which I don't know, right? I don't have access to Facebook.com. I just make the request on my site. And then you visit it. And then when you do that, HTTP 1.1 will start compressing. And it says, oh, there is T and there is 3, T, T. Oh, let me compress that. So all of a sudden, you added a letter and then you inspect and says, oh, it was the length was 100. Now it's, I don't know, it's 90. That means whatever you did, you inserted, has some commonality between the access token that you want to hack and the text that you inserted. So if it becomes smaller, that means you just have some similarity. If you inserted something, I don't know, a car, which has nothing in common, yes, then the text, the compressed text, will become longer because you just increased it. There is no commonality. Isn't that genius? This is called a crime attack, and nobody solved it. Nobody can solve this. Because all of a sudden now, you can guess any password with few attacks. If you send the password, or if you send something, if you have continuous access to the request, again, as encrypted, you just look at the length, and you have information at what you request. This is genius. That's how crime works, essentially. By you as an attacker inserting text, which is harmless, you're just sending extra text, right? But if you check the length, you can see if that shrinked, that means you just inserted a text that matches the token or matches the credential or matches the password that you want to essentially tick. Genius attack. So that's how crime. So HTTP2 came in and tried to solve all these problems. Says, okay, we have compression. We have the problem with compression. By the way, Speedy, the first version of HTTP2, had the same exact problem because they were compressing on air everything. They compress and then the server will decompress, right? So HTTP came and says, okay, let's solve the problem with multiplexing, guys. This is silly, right? So let's invent the idea of streams or channels, right? And in these streams, you can send one request per stream. So we essentially created multiple channels or multiple TCP connections. Think of them as a mini connections. That's how I think about streams. But they have headers. They have their own, essentially, their headers and their metadata about what is this request and which stream this belongs to. Now, all of a sudden, you can send as many requests as you want. I think the default is, maximum default is 200. So now, if you make HTTP2 requests, like you make 100 requests, that's absolutely fine because these will be treated differently. You can send all this stuff, and then if request number 100 is ready, right, because it was a quick request, the server can respond to that stream because it's a different stream. So they can build the packets that make that response and just responds back in stream number 100 while the request number 1 is busy querying the database or querying GraphQL or querying something slow. Right? That's absolutely fine. That's the problem with HTTP/1. That's the major, major problem with HTTP/1. And then now what the response was responding, we don't have a problem. There is no head of line blocking anymore when it comes to response. However, there is a problem, the same as HTTP pipelining, when it comes to the request processing. So if I send these 100 requests, right, again, in different streams, on top of TCP, because that's what HTTP2 is on top of, then request number 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 will be translated into, yeah, they are streams. What is that? What are streams? They are just a bunch of TCP segments. Is that right? That's just TCP. That means they are sequenced. That means this sequence, they better be nailed down to the sequence number. That means they have to be ordered. That means if request number 100 and let's say request number 1 has a stinking segment that was lost, all those stinking response requests have to wait for that packet or that segment to actually arrive so we can make sense of what you're saying as a TCP segments. Because the TCP stack, they're just stinking segments. They don't know what is stream. They don't know anything about that. So to solve all this request, imagine this, like you're requesting CSS, a JavaScript file, an index.html, and then all this stuff, and then there is all of the way you're requesting all of that stuff, simple stuff, but you're requesting them later, and there is one packet for some reason, one segment that was lost. The server technically does not know what you sent. It did not receive those requests because most of these packets were not delivered to the server because there was one chain that was broken. And in TCP, there is a hard rule that says, hey, if there's one packet, I keep saying packet, if there's one segment that is lost, there is a sequence gap. You said, oh, 1, 2, 3, 4. Segment. Where's segment number 3? Where's the sequence number of this 3? It's lost. Sorry, I don't understand this. Retransmit. So retransmit number 3. Until you actually reach that, once you have all these sequence packets, segments, then all these packets, the 100 or more packets, the segments that we talked about, it will be delivered to the web server, and the web server will say, all right, now the application will say, this from 1 to 3 is actually stream number 1, from 5 to 7 is actually stream number 2, and okay, it will start processing and do that stuff. So pay attention to the processing aspects here. So the app, maybe a stack below it, had to do some work to understand the request. This is something we don't do in HTTP 1.1. HTTP 1.1 is just a segment that I receive from the TCP stack is the request. Or maybe there's like a delayed, right? So maybe one, I don't do any processing. It's just, take the content. There you go. That's part of the content. But now in TCP with HTTP 2, no, you don't just take the content. Because the content have headers, have HTTP2 headers. So you have to know, what stream is this? Oh, this is stream 2. Okay. Oh, this is stream 3. More CPU. That's why HTTP2 is slower when it comes to processing requests, because it needs to understand this. It needs more CPU usage. So, and Lucidchart, I believe I made a video about that. They saw, HTTP2, that's fun. Let's just move to HTTP2. They moved to HTTP2. From HTTP1, and all of a sudden their CPUs started maxing out to 100% because of that. Obviously, they were not ready. There was like other problems, but be careful while implementing HTTP2. You need beefier machines when it comes to that. So we still have the head of line blocking with HTTP2. Not when it comes to the responses. The responses are fine. It's just when it comes to the request processing layer, this. So we solved one problem, but we still have the other, which is the TCP stack. That's the problem with TCP. Adita says, one segment need not be one request. Yeah, correct. Yeah, one request can translate to multiple segments. But if you're lucky, you can, if you send a small request, it can fit into this TCP segment as long as it meets the maximum transmission unit. I think it's called MTU. Otto is doing a great job. He's answering a question. Thank you, dear. Look at all this stuff. Love your accent, Zuhair. Do I have an accent? Of course I do. Yeah. So for you who don't know, I am originally from Bahrain. So I have a thick Arab accent. Yes, my friends. Back in engineering is very nice. Yeah. I go to the desert and drink camel milk in my free time. And yeah, and I eat rice all the time. And yes. Vim or Emacs? Vim. I never used Emacs, so it's Vim. Hey, Beach House. Otto is the best, man. I said, could you please suggest some good books for the system design? I don't have any. Sorry, but I will if I find good ones, definitely. There is, yeah, when it comes to database system design, it's called The Fundamentals of Database Systems. That's the best box. I recommend that. I'll link it up for you guys. So Fundamentals of Database Systems, I think. That's a book I learned about all the ACID stuff and all stuff. Let me fix that. So what did we discuss so far? We talked about the problems of HTTP 1.1, and we talked about the problems of HTTP 2. The problems of HTTP 2 was basically this one, which is the head of line blocking. So if you send a lot of requests in HTTP 2, you still can be head of line blocked real hard when it comes to requests. What the heck was that? So that's the problem with HTTP 2. And then Quick came into the problem. Before we move to Quick, let's talk about one solution, because we still have one problem that we didn't solve in HTTP 2, which is the compression of headers. We know about crime, right? Crime. Compression ratio info leak made easy. That's just a funny name. Sometimes I think this research just made up, make things up. Just so they can get a nice acronym. I swear to God. I swear. You are awesome, Hussein. You are more awesome, Shriyanas. Postgres versus MySQL. Man, this is a tough question. Don't ask me this tough question. Tech genius. These are tough questions. It really depends. I hate that answer. I know. I hate this answer. But I can spend just a live stream talking about the difference between Postgres and MySQL. But most of my use cases, I tend toward Postgres. Just there's one feature in Postgres that I love and doesn't exist in MySQL, and that's called transactional DDL. What does that mean? I mean, if you do a create table in the middle of a transaction, that auto commits because it's a DDL. It changed the schema of your table, of your database, right? And that's commits that for the longest time. Postgres, Postgres, what Postgres do, it allows you to do DDLs in the middle of transaction, and you can roll them back. How genius is this? So if you're doing database upgrades, which I do a lot in my apps, like I say, here's a script that upgrades your Postgres schema, right? Because I'm giving you an app, right? I'm giving you a software that built on a Postgres with a data model. And then I release new software releases, but that requires upgrade of the schema. Now I need a new index here. I need a new table here. I need a new field here. How do you upgrade the user, the customer's database, right? You have to make a backup and then run, right? And a restore if it goes bad. With Postgres, you don't have this problem. Just run it. If it failed, it's going to roll back. So you're clean, even with DDLs. Nobody does that. Even Oracle doesn't do that. So that's one feature I love. But does that mean Postgres is better than MySQL? Definitely. Definitely.
No.
It depends. Again. Do you think database normalization still matters? I don't know. It's like, I have to go back, like, why people invented normalization. Was it to store, to save space? I think that's when they taught it in the university. I was like saying, this is silly. I remember I was 19 years old, and was it 19? How old are I? 2001. 2001. How old are I? Math is hard. Yeah, I was 19, yeah. About right. So I was 19. I was like, this is just dumb. You wanted to break us. I have my table right there. Why are we breaking it up? It's because you're duplicating rows. And that's what they were keeping. The professor keeps saying, oh, you don't want to duplicate rows. Just save it once so that you save storage. Because if you're going to duplicate stuff, that's bad. Because back in 2001, storage was scarce. Scarce. Scarce or scarce? What's the English word for it? Hey guys, it's scarce. Scarce, I think. So, scarce, yeah. Because now, I don't know. Denormalization became a hip in late 2012, I think 2003. People started denormalizing because it's like joins are the worst because I don't want to join stuff with large tables. Plus, people barely know how indexes works. Most people working with database do not know how indexing work and how full table scans work. So they end up scanning the whole table and just giving bad performance. So yeah. All right. So let's move to quick. Before quick, we need to talk about HTTP/2 compression. So there was a problem, which is the compression problem or the crime, which we talked about. Speedy and HTTP/2 solved it by inventing something called HPAC. Ichpakko. That was Japanese, by the way, for HPAC. If you don't know Japanese, just add O at the end. I'm being silly. Ichpakko. Ichpakko is an HTTP/2 feature that allows you to compress headers. And you might say, Hussein, didn't you just say compression on the air is bad because people can sniff and just insert and sniff, insert and sniff, insert and sniff until they find out what the content of the packets are, even if it's encrypted. Yeah, but that's what they don't do. They HPAC turns HTTP/2 kind of into a stateful protocol, but not really. Let me explain. It stores a table on the back end called the static table, and there is a dynamic table. And each header that repeats a lot, all we do is basically store an entry and we reference an ID, a small ID, one byte that reference that entry. So if you're storing, I don't know, authority XXX colon slash Cloudflare dot in dot net dot is, this becomes one byte. So wow, that's a nice compression. So just a reference table becomes a hash table essentially, right? So everything that's the static table, things that always repeat, content type always repeat, right? What else? Cookie always repeats, right? The cookie header itself, the key cookie, the string cookie, right? That's a static, and then a future request only references. Okay, there is one byte that points to that entry in the table, right? So that's nice compression. And even if you sniff in the middle, you're not gonna see anything because guess what? We're not compressing your content anymore. We're referencing it. So that's very clever, right? So all of a sudden now, the dynamic content for the headers, like I don't know, stuff like cookies, like changes all the time, which is not static, right? That string of the cookie, your access token, will be referenced on the server with another byte. And then your client will be notified, oh, by the way, this thing, they are over here. It's now, please reference it in the future with the bit number 3, something like that. So once you do that, you just shrunk the compression and you get lots of good stuff and compressions. Isn't the connection keep alive? That's another thing. Thanks, Abdullah. That's another thing, right? Connection keep alive. All the stuff that repeats all the time. But there's stuff that dynamic. So you would generate essentially entries for the client to keep referencing them. So that's kind of sneaky compression. It's just a reference table. So that's how HPAC works, right? So that's how they solve the problem with a client. So now, even if they're middle, if you're inserting stuff, yeah, we're gonna compress it for you, but you have no clue what was the original content, right? Yeah, you might say, Hussein, but the first request must have been full, uncompressed, right? But yeah, he does not have the idea of actually destroying and recreating the same TCP connection in order to send that request repeated. The attacker does not have repeatability anymore, right? With the original compression, that repeatability exists because we're always compressing on the fly, always compressing on the fly. So that's HPAC. And we had one big problem with HPAC. That we're going to solve in quick. All right, we have, how much time we have? Meet quick. But we're going to be quick. Ha ha. That was a dad joke, I'm sorry. So quick, guys. Quick says, you know what? All these problems that we have is because of stinking TCP. It's like a stinking TCP. Trying to be smart, trying to be flow control, trying to do all this sequencing thing. I mean, we're trying to do smart thing over here on top of the application. And the TCP is destroying this, right? Because TCP is a source. It's trying to do its job. It's trying to make you give you order delivery of the packets. But what if the things that you're sending don't have to be in order, like request number one, request number three, request number two, request number three, request number four? They don't have to be in order. Request number four can arrive as its own, right? They don't have to be like in order, literally, right? So all of a sudden, the TCP will feature becomes a bug, right? Because it's nasty, right? Correct. HTTP Quick is not HTTP. HTTP 3 is built on top of Quick, actually. And I'm going to also talk about why do we need HTTP 3 if we have just HTTP 2. HTTP 2, just switch it to work on top of Quick, because that's the first question that came in my mind. HTTP 2 exactly like HTTP 3, but there is one thing, actually multiple things. One of the things that caused us to switch to HTTP 3 instead of just using HTTP 2 is HPAC. Which is the compression thing. They invented something. It just does not work with Quick. It will give you the same problem, which is the head of line broken. That's why we shift to HTTP 3. That's one reason, at least. All right. So let's talk about Quick. Quick is exact same idea of streams, but it's built on top of UDP. So now, the application layer, which is Quick, it's actually built a little bit down. It's a layer 4 protocol, but it has the knowledge to work with UDP. And if you send me multiple streams, I'll guarantee orders only within segments in the same stream itself. So if you send me, because UDP is unreliable, doesn't have anything, it's just send and forget. So we have full control over that. So Quick came in and says, okay, let's do streams, but let's build intelligence within the stream level so that we order packets only at the stream level. And all of a sudden, if you send 5 requests now in Quick as different 5 streams, if request number 5 arrives first, sure, we're going to process it because it's independent. In TCP, we cannot do that because all of these 5 are just a single sequenced packets. And to the TCP, this is just a single stream of packets, and we have to guarantee it in order. So Quick came in and says, okay, we really need to kind of break this down into multiple streams, and we guarantee order within the stream. So yeah, my request itself, the get request, has to be ordered, these packets, small packets that makes up the get request has to be ordered within the same stream, but it doesn't have to. Request number 100 can arrive without the need of request number 1 being finished. That's the first problem solved. The second problem solves, which is very beautiful. What do we do with HTTP2 and HTTP 1.1, guys? The first thing we do, first thing. Let's say you're doing an XML HTTP request or fetch command, or using React, and you're making a request, right? You're sending a request. In order to send a request to the HTTP protocol, you have to first establish a TCP connection. And that's what, that's SYN, SYNACK, and then ACK. Why? Because we need to agree on this sequencing, right? We need to understand the packets. We need to understand the sequence, all of that. So we do this three-way handshake, which we talked about. Then after that, we do a TLS so that we can encrypt, right? So in case of TLS 1.2, we do 01, 2, and then 1 and 2, two round trip. So we can agree on the keys and symmetric keys so we can encrypt. So how many packets, how many stuff we do before we actually talk, lots of stuff. UDPQuick says, why don't we just do the handshake and the encryption in the same request, in the same packet? And you might say, Hussein, we can do the same thing on TCP. Why don't we, when we do a SYN, why don't we just do the TLS on top of SYN? Oh, I wish we can. We cannot evolve TCP, unfortunately, because there are a lot of boxes in the middle that are trying to be smart. And they're looking at the SYN packet and says, okay, SYN packet has to look like this, and it has to have this header, and I have to have this. Oh, what are you sending me? This doesn't look like SYN. Meh, drop. Most internet routers work this way. They just keep looking, and if something feels nasty, it just drops it or different. So that's why we cannot evolve protocols. So they had to make a new packets protocols so they can evolve it. So now all of a sudden, guys, you still have a quick handshake, but that thing is encrypted, almost encrypted. Because we're going to do the SYN quick, and then we're going to also do the TLS handshake in the same request. And all of a sudden, one round trip, you're ready to rock and roll. One round trip. Not only that, you have so beautiful quick handshake. So starting communication so fast. This is so good with quick. I feel like I'm a marketing quick for them. Yeah, get one free with quick. So I don't like TCP. I love TCP. TCP is great for certain cases, but when we're trying to build something else, it the limitation actually bubbles up. That's unfortunately. Right. But again, quick is the new TCP as people try to market it as. So we have a better handshake. We have a one RTT. Even people are working on not just one RTT, zero RTT, which is zero round trip. You can send your data in the first request. In the first thing, you can just immediately establish connection. You might say, how? The server and the client has to agree on something, on these sequences. They have to agree on the encryption. They have to agree on all this. How do they do that? Yeah, if you have previous knowledge with a server, you can essentially skip a round trip and says, hey, by the way, you know me, still same OG, right? And let's just communicate. Let's just start communicating because, hey, I know you. You all know me, still same OG, but I've been low key. So all of a sudden, you can essentially establish this communication immediately and send a request. And in TCP, this is called TCP Fast Open. If you have as an idea of having a cookie in TCP, so you can, hey, by the way, I did communicate with you before, and it's on me again, right? Can I come in again, please? Thank you so much. So that's what happens. So yeah, so let's talk about a little bit, final thing before we end the stream, is HTTP3. But before HTTP3, why do we have HTTP3? The idea of HPAC, which is the compression algorithm used in HTTP2, has a single limitation. Quick is not stateless. No, it's stateful. Stateful as can be. There's everything. We're storing everything everywhere in the server. Yeah. HTTP3, which is on top of Quick, is stateless. We're storing everything. Quick is definitely stateful. What if packet drop in UDP? Good question. Quick will take care of retransmission. Because UDP does as a protocol does not retransmit anything, right? It's just like, hey, yeah, you're relying on me. I'm not gonna do anything. So it will just retransmit itself. So UDP is very interesting protocol because it's firewalls do not like UDP. Sometimes they block it. So that's why we have all sorts of scenarios to with Quick as a fallback to TCP, which kind of sucks, but that's changing though. That's changing in the internet. The internet is starting to relax. And say, okay, UDP is a good thing. Also, UDP, I talked about UDP hole punching. That's another thing because UDP, unlike TCP, it's connectionless. There is no connection that you, okay, you want this target request or you communicate between me and you and I know you and I have previous knowledge. UDP is stateless, right? So it does not have a state, doesn't store anything, but the routers actually do store some states. It's like, okay, you sent a request, let's say DNS request, UDP, and this is the port that we opened for you in case the UDP server responds back. So I'm going to leave this port open a little bit for a while until we get a result. And then once we get the result, I'm going to close it. Right? That's how routers essentially work with UDP. They open a punch. They punch a hole in the router so that you can get back information. Because what does that mean if you immediately as a device behind NAT, you just get a request all out of the blue? How does the router know to forward it to you? Right? You must have made a request prior. So there are a lot of intricacies when it comes to Quick and nailing it really well. When it comes to UDP, and there is like timeouts, and sometimes routers will just immediately close the connection. It's like, oh, what the heck is this? Close it. That's why the connection migration is also a way to keep Quick as a stateless protocol. It transfers some metadata called the connection ID, so that if this happens, like the router decided to close the port, you can essentially reestablish the Quick connection and using zero RTT and just continue over and then do it, just move to another connection just like that. Another way, like if you left your home and then you switch connection from 4G to Wi-Fi or Wi-Fi to 4G, all of a sudden you get a new IP address, right? In TCP, that actually breaks the connection. But the benefit of Quick here is you have a connection ID. So the server, if you send it a connection ID, the same connection ID from a different IP address, the server will recognize you and says, oh, wasn't you just, you were connecting from this IP address? I see you're connecting from a different IP address, but I'm going to let you in, son. I'm going to let you in. So that's another feature in Quick. The final thing we're going to discuss, because before we end the stream, because you guys are tired, is HPAC and QPAC. HPAC is the compression algorithm that we talked about in HTTP2, which is, hey, let's just transfer this information. And all of a sudden, if I send a request, we have streams, right, in HTTP2. Like I send a request and the information that says header cookie is blah, right? And then the server will once that information will reach the server, right? That the server will respond back with the new marker that points to that compressed header, because that we stored the dynamic table. And then a future request can reuse the same cookie ID that we compressed and in the same request. And that works just fine, right? Because why? Because funny enough, HTTP2 relies on TCP for the order, so that if you send stuff in order, they're going to arrive in order because that's how TCP works. Whether it's stream number one or stream number 100. That's the problem with head of line blocking. All of a sudden, HTTP2 head of line blocking, which is considered bad, all of a sudden it's a feature actually for HPAC because you have to have the headers in order because you're relying on new request or later request to reference the thing that you just compressed because that's how HPAC works. Unfortunately, with Quick, there is no order. There is no order. So if you send something in stream one and all of a sudden you compress that, stream 100 does not know about it. It might have actually sent started referencing something that has been compressed, but it doesn't exist anymore, right? Because your request actually arrived before that. There is no order. So you start getting all this problem with Quick. So they invented a brand new compression algorithm called QPACO. That's the new compression algorithm in Quick. And because of that brand new Quick Pack protocol, which I'm going to make a video about, new video, they could not use HTTP2 on top of Quick. That's the one of the main reasons. Otherwise, we would be just, hey, let's just use HTTP2 on top of Quick because all the features of HTTP2 is now on Quick. So now HTTP2 is just a very thin layer. Why we need a new protocol? Not really, not quite. We could not directly do one-to-one. So Quick have all the features of HTTP2, but is a lower layer. By the way, Quick doesn't have headers or anything like that. It's a lower layer 4 protocol. So it's very close to the network compared to HTTP, right? And I talked about that many times. So yeah, that's why we had to invent HTTP3, which is slightly thinner layer on top of Quick that gives us the statelessness that we talked about. And has a brand new compression algorithm called QPAC. And that's mainnet. Let's take a few questions and end the stream. That's what I wanted to talk about, basically. Just Quick, the history of Quick. Why did we invent Quick? And let's take some questions before we end the stream. Hey, so actually, I am just a beginner and learning server-side development. I have a question. Is ERER or UML really important for the backend? Oh, entity relationship. UML was the hype back in 2004, 2005. I mean, I have a book here on UML. UML Distilled, I think that's the code. Hopefully that's a, don't fall. Can you guys see it? UMLO Distincto, Distildo, UMLO, third edition. Matt, what's his name? I forgot, Martin Fowler. He's a well-known computer science professor. Is it professor? I don't know. But this book, UML, taught me a lot of stuff in my career. UML Distilled. So it is, I wouldn't say, UML became a hype a little bit, but not. I don't see people talking about that anymore. It's just a way to describe your app, right? And the flaws about this is that it's too detailed, in my opinion. It's just too detailed to a way that you can't really use it to explain to an architect at the architect level, which is most what I do. You can't use UML to explain architecture. I think so. It's just used to explain classes and stuff that's low level, right? And even if you do architecture, it's just so weird. So I used it to build class diagram, which is the best. Class diagram in case of object-oriented. All the time I use UML. It's very, very... I built so many class diagrams because... Class diagram, if you want developer class diagrams and UML, basically, which is the language used, is the best thing. But is it for higher level architecture? I don't see it useful. UML stands for useless time wasting. I kind of agree with you. Yeah, so don't sweat it. It's just unified modeling language. They tried. I don't think it succeeded. Sir, I watch your video and provide great content. Thank you, Deep. Appreciate you. Appreciate you. Hussein, salam alaikum. I want to ask you best design pattern for you in the backend strategy. You're talking about the actual design pattern, right? Strategy. That's my favorite one. Strategy design pattern. Observer is another good one. I have my ER diagrams open all the time when I do something my database. Yeah, we don't talk about that. The entity relationship. I mean, yeah, working with, you have to have an ER diagram. I mean, describing a database. Otherwise, how do you know where your tables are? So the unlike UML, and I don't know if ER is actually a UML. I don't think it is. Maybe it is. I'm not sure. But AR is very, very important. I don't see a limitation of ER. I don't think we need a new thing. ER is best. Is good. Can you share some resources to learn more about backend engineering? I mean, the whole channel is about backend engineering. I mean, yeah, things are not ordered, but what you have is like you have to just watch content. I have like three playlists: introduction to backend engineering, intermediate backend engineering, and the advanced, right? If you watch them in order, you're gonna get an idea, and you're gonna start having a lot of questions, and that's the best thing. Once you have started having a lot of questions, you start asking them back, and then if you have more questions, that means you are on the right path. Just like in a video game, if you go to a path in a video game and you see enemies fighting you, that means you're on the right path. That's the right path to the boss, right? Same thing with backend engineering. It's a video game. You just go, and if you have difficulties, you're on the right path. If everything makes sense, or you just say, oh, that's because of that's it. If you don't have this, that means there's room to grow. And I have this all the time. I'm not perfect. I'm learning to this day, every single day. And it's a continuous learning process. Are you going to become a backend engineer in a day or two or three or 3, 5, 7 years? No, I don't think so. It's a continu You have to come with a mindset. I hate that word. With a mindset that says like, yeah, have a mindset that, hey, you want to keep learning. This is not, it's a fun process. Enjoy the process of it, right? And make sure that, hey, you're not going to know everything because you're not going to know everything. Software engineering is a huge field. And take a look at the tools. Some tools are crap. Some tools are just fluff. And that you have to be careful of this. Don't fall into the quicksand of fancy tools. Learn the fundamentals. Abdullah, thank you, Hussein. I like your show. Thank you so much. I'm glad you love it. If not UML, then what? There is something called the three, four C's. Four C's, I think. Was it the 4C architecture? I have not checked it, to be honest, but this is all, if you think about it, this is all over engineering. This is, you want to draw an architecture, just draw stupid boxes. That's it. I mean, why do we need to standard? I mean, yeah, if you have a simple, just three, four boxes that explains your architecture, and then you can talk through it. That's it. Slideshow. You don't really need UML. You don't really need fancy stuff. If you want to go deeper, then you need a little bit fancier architecture. You need more annotation. I like look at what Uber does and other companies, Kafka and stuff like that. They don't use standardized stuff to describe. This is like, hey, how can I get the point as quick as possible? The point is not to learn a new thing. The point is to deliver an idea to you. How can I deliver my architecture as an idea to you so that it's not confusing? So the less stuff in the diagram, the better. Akash, I just got recommended your channel. I am going through your content. Seems awesome. Thank you so much. Let me know if you have any feedback. I can always improve. What do you think of traffic reverse proxy? Meh, 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 meh. I don't know about traffic, man. I don't know. It's just, you watch my video on traffic. I made two videos. I made the actual video describing my process and my pain to learn traffic. I was like, The same conversation we're having right now, the complexity. I mean, man, if you want to explain something, there are like 700 terminology in traffic, and that makes it a complex piece of tech. And complex piece of tech do not succeed. That's my opinion. They added so many abstractions. And every abstraction you add, oh, this is a middleware, this is an I don't know what, this is a edge, this is it's just complicated things. Sometimes, well, that's what happened when developers start going up and started designing, because they start want to abstract everything in their head, and that doesn't work as a back-end engineering design, in my opinion. Again, everything I say here, in my opinion. If you use Traffic and you find it good, that's good, but I don't like to use a software that is just a black box that does stuff I don't know about, and I like to understand it. And when I try to understand traffic, I failed. I failed so bad. You might have a different opinion. Even Envoy, I mean, Envoy, I used to give it a I mean, I kind of liked it, but then, come on. I came back to Envoy as like I keep forgetting what things are, and you that's not a good sign. If you don't, you have a lot of abstractions in a software, then if you go back and come back and you start forgetting stuff, that's not a good sign. With HA proxy, that's the simplest, most beautiful proxy I saw. It is so simple, and when you the configuration is so simple too. Yeah, you can go advanced, but the idea of having a front end and a back end and then chained, that is the best thing ever. Because once you have that, it's so simple to describe. Hey, a front end listen to a port, and there's a back end listen to another port, and then you can just map things together, and then you can control this mapping. Done. Again, I even felt the same with traffic. Some people feel the same. Some people say, no, you're wrong. And yeah, it's just an opinion at the end of the day, but I might be wrong. Is PHP really dying? I don't know. I mean, I don't think a language dies. I mean, if it works for you, use it. I mean, what does it mean, die? Is it just is not hype enough? Is that what it means by dying? Quick HTTP/3 will take longer than HTTP/2 because SSL libraries like OpenSSL needs to be modified. Yeah. Otto is right. Quick as a library, I think Quiche. Check out Cloudflare Quiche. That's a quick library that's being developed. So quick, again, guys, you have to think about how these things work, right? Because to use Quick, you need a client library if you want to use it in your app. If you want to use it in browser, then if your server supports Quick, you're done. Because the browser supports Quick now. HTTP/3 is now supported in most browsers by default. You can enable that. We didn't talk about how does the client know that the server supports Quick. That's a completely different beast. Because you might say, Hussein, ALP, an application layer program negotiation in TLS. Well, the problem is ALPN is a was designed in to be in the TLS. So if you do a TLS and say, hey, do you support HTTP/3? How did you do that? You first had to establish a TCP connection first, right? Once you do a TCP connection and the server tells you, hey, yeah, I do support Quick. So all of a sudden, your TCP connection that you just opened is useless. You have to close it and open a UDP Quick connection. And that's what people are trying to solve. Some people are adding an ELT service header in the DNS so that when you want to go to cloudflare.com, which supports Quick. Hey, what's my IP address, Cloudflare? What's your IP address, Cloudflare? It's gonna tell you, hey, it's 1.3.3.4.7, and then here's the port, and there's no port. There's the IP address, and by the way, this IP address supports Quick. So if you want to communicate in HTTP, use HTTP/3. That's fine. You're gonna communicate with HTTP/3. So now you have the knowledge before the fact that you open the TCP connection. You don't have to open TCP connection. You just immediately open it Quick. And that's something they are working on. Do you play the PlayStation on your shelf. No, this one is a PlayStation 3 and this one is a PlayStation 2. I don't know if you guys see it. Yeah, this is PS2, this is a PS3. I have a PS4 and I'm getting a PS5. Public your Udemy courses. I don't know about that one. So I made my Udemy courses private because main reasons is Udemy, first of all, Udemy is a terrible platform. I don't like it. It's just the coupon system is ridiculous and the limits they put in you. And then like my goal is just what I do is I put my content as a course for a few months and then I make it all free on YouTube with ads. That's my goal. Because I want to make it on YouTube. But when I do that, I want to turn my Udemy course into free. Because that's it. I just made it available on YouTube, all of it. Right? So if I want to turn it into Udemy as a free, they don't let you anymore. This is, it has to be 2 hours. But I have 11 hours content. Why can't you make it? Why? Why this stupid restriction? It doesn't make any sense. So it's not flexible. So I'm moving everything to a new platform. That's why I privated everything. I can't make it free. That's the reason. I cannot make it available for free. And I can't for the life of me. It's not fair to make it available for $10 or whatever the price is. Because some people will not like this. It's like, okay, the courses, the videos, they are not ordered, but the videos are on YouTube, but you're selling it to us on Udemy. That's kind of shady. So I didn't think about this, but they're right. It's like, why am I doing this? First, I would try to sell this as like, okay, you don't have ads on Udemy. They said, no, what? I can get, again, I have a YouTube premium with no ads. So what's the value? I said, you get slides. But that's not enough. That's not enough value. So it wasn't enough value to sell it. That, again, that's just my opinion. So in the future, I decided to know, you know what? I'm not going to use Udemy. I'm going to build my own course. I'm going to make it in one of these teachable, whatever these things. And then I'm going to make it dedicated you content just for that, right? Because I don't like Udemy as a platform. So I'm moving everything. Not moving, just these courses will eventually become free in the future, right? That's the goal. What platform? Teachable, maybe. I still don't, I didn't decide. You guys suggest, what do you guys prefer as a platform? Anything or learning Go? Go is great. Go is a great language, multi-threaded, and it's built for networking, so it's really good. Really, really good. What are some good reads on engineering books? I'll make a video about this, but I recommend again before books. And some people don't like this, but it depends on what you're trying to learn. Right? Nothing wrong with YouTube videos and that, but they give you shallow knowledge. If you want a deep knowledge, you have to read the RFCs about the tech special back in engineering because they're just literally no books talking about HTTP, for example. And if you have a book about HTTP, it's not deep enough, in my opinion. So there are a lot of books about HTTP. There's some books, good books about database systems. Of course, there's no RFC for databases, right? So you need a book. A good book is a fundamental about database systems. There are certain books that are good. When, like Unix, if you want to learn about Linux and Unix and all this stuff, then you have a book. Some cookbooks are, it's like watching a YouTube video, so I don't know what the value of that. But yeah, some cookbooks, in fact, some cookbooks are really good. It's like they are long and they give you straight what you want to do, right? But you don't find these rich cookbooks on YouTube as a video. Do your own platform. That's a lot of work. I don't have time to build my own platform. I'd rather use it. It's like time is very precious, guys, right? It's just me designing my own platform is useless because what am I going to do? If there's a platform that saves me the time that I can publish an existing platform, then I save a lot of time. Just publish an existing platform that is suitable after, of course, after I test it and make sure it's good. Right? Me building a new platform for myself doesn't make any sense. Right. I'm gonna spend 100% of my time maintaining the platform with the bugs and with all of everything because it's not gonna be perfect. I don't. The moment I build my own platform, I'm done. I cannot make videos anymore because most of my time will be spent maintaining the site and worrying about bugs and worrying about how this customer didn't get this didn't get the payment. I want all these things. So that's why it doesn't make sense. Do you compose these sessions every Saturday? Yes, I missed last Saturday because of Thanksgiving, the holiday. But yeah, every Saturday I try. And I usually schedule them for you guys to get a notification. So hit that notification bell. If you're watching in the YouTube, there is a bell icon. Turn on all notification. I post a lot. And this week, dude, I posted a daily video. And some people think, how do you do that? Basically, I don't force myself to post daily. I just post a video whenever I feel that there's something I want to talk about. And I just don't wait. I just try to post one video a day. Sometimes I don't have, like today, I say, okay, we're gonna do a live stream. I'm not gonna post anything. There's no need to post a video. But there's a lot of time. So, and the when do I get a time? The only time I get is this, the 7 o'clock to 8. Because 8, I start work at 8, right? I wake up at 5. I do my own thing. I play PlayStation from 5 in the morning after I do everything. So 5:30, 5. I walk the dog and do all this stuff. So six, I start playing PlayStation. Sometimes I watch anime. There's the new anime show. I'm in love with it. Yeah, I do all stuff, man. I do so much stuff. Like I entertain myself. It's not always learning, learning, learning. And I guarantee you guys should always find other hobbies. This back in engineering is joyful for me to search and learn, and I do it during the day. It's like, oh, let me search about HQuick. Let me search about HQuick. Let me search about QPAC. Yesterday, I spent the whole day stressing about how Postgres stores character values. Can you imagine? I just like a whole day on and off. Oh, how does this work? But why is that? What is toast? What's the difference between varchar and char? What's the difference between text? So, and that's the question, the collateral knowledge that. Someone in the comments said, asked me a question that challenged me. It's like, well, what if I have a text field and the idea of updating the text field actually grew the row larger? What happened to the indexes? And I was like, oh shit, I don't know what the heck happens. Really, I don't know. So I had to go research. And that just bugs me. You know, it's like, oh, there's one thing that I just don't know and gives me into a hole of learning. But yeah, in the morning, watch stuff. I do things to relax. It's not a good idea to show the chat, by the way. Why? You guys don't like the showing me the chats? That's good. I don't know. If you are, I think always like showing the chats is good because you show the reply because YouTube doesn't really show the reply all the time. So showing the chat kind of is good. You can see what's going on. And I don't care about. I mean, this chat is clean. I mean, you guys are amazing. I don't see any trolls or anyone like that. So you guys are awesome. So it's pretty good. Learning data structures in C still worth it? Is that a question? I would say yes, definitely. Yeah, C and data structures. If you don't know anything about data structures, sure, learn them. Are they chat windows good? Yeah, I think chat windows is good. Yeah, people like it. Can you provide your approach on learning new things? I talked about it in a video. Let me find that. Which video was that? Which video was that? Learning a new thing. Yeah. I think, how do I learn new technologies? I make multiple videos about that. I can't remember. I'll post the video though. But we can see the video in full screen mode, seeing the comments. Okay. Yeah, I can make it that the thing is a little bit bigger as well, I think. Let me, oh yeah, I can do that. See, that's bigger. That takes skills, by the way. Not everybody knows how to resize a chat window. That takes skills, guys. So, thank you so much. Thank you. I know, I'm genius. Yeah, resizing, woo, that's hard. Yeah. Is Kubernetes the future? I think so. I see that it's going to be a layer that we don't have to maintain anymore. Just like the operating system today. Right? The operating system today, you just install Linux and you don't have to worry about it, right? I mean, not everybody knows how Linux works, right? I mean, I don't know the intricacy of Linux, and yet I'm using it, right? In the future, now I complain about Kubernetes a lot because it's still in its infancy, right? But in the future, I think this will be isolated from all of us, the whole thing, right? But again, it will be like something that, okay, I want to ship an app, just you write app and then it will be running on the cloud, and that's it. Now it depends, where are you at the stack as an engineer? Do you want to debug why things are slow? Then you need knowledge in operating systems. I didn't have the need to dive into operating system, the kernel, to debug my app yet. I might be in the future. I dove deep. I had to learn the protocols. I have to learn all of this stuff because I needed to. And whenever I need something, I'm gonna do it. That's the goal here, right? And Kubernetes in the future, I think is gonna be the same thing. I think it's gonna be the same thing. Kubernetes, now you have to know how it works, but in the future, it will just become something that everybody uses, I think. So it is the future. It's a great technology. My only beef is just a lot of people actually maintain it themselves, and which is yet not streamlined enough, I guess. So in the future, maybe that will turn on. Turn slow mode, people spamming. Oh, really? All right, spam mode is on. How do I do that? Slow mode. Slow mode. Slow mode. Slow mode. Slow mode. Stream setting. Slow mode. Slow mode. Add delay. I can't. Why? Why can't I add slow mode? Doesn't seem like I can do that. Hey, enable slow mode. And let's say just 10 seconds. I don't think. Slow mode. Oh, slow mode on. Hello, brother. What do you recommend for building real-time system? Real-time system. There is a new protocol called Web Transport. I think that will be great for real-time systems. WebSocket is a candidate today. There is a head of line blocking problem with WebSockets, but it's not that bad. On top of TCP, UDP, definitely UDP is a good, just if you build it on top of raw UDP, definitely a good idea. That's a lot of work though. Thanks. I learned Docker. Can I run Kubernetes in a single machine? Yeah, you can. I think it's an overkill in my opinion. Do you recommend any roadmap for backend? I looked at some of the backend roadmap. They're pretty good. I think they're a little bit verbose. I'm planning to do my own roadmap, just my opinion about this backend and what you should learn, what should not. And this is just the roadmap you see is just scary if you look at that stuff, right? So I'm gonna make it a little bit more coarser, let's say. So it's like bigger boxes instead of showing you tools, showing you what you need to learn as concept and fundamentals. But yeah, these are good, pretty good stuff. Alaikum assalam, DM. Docker or Podman? What's Podman? I'm not familiar with Podman. Why weakly type languages are moving to strongly type? Oh, tell me. I don't know. Yeah, I have no idea. Yeah, I'm still starting to understand. Like, we designed weakly type languages such as JavaScript and Python. So that because they are weakly, because we didn't want to. There was a reason we built this, because we don't care about strong type language. Some people, some use cases didn't care about that. So there are strongly typed languages such as C, C++, Java, C Sharp, and then there is weakly type. There's like no type. There's const, and then there's no type. And people won't move to that for a reason, and it became popular. Now these languages are moving back to strongly typed. Why? Nobody's telling me why. Because we relied on these languages to do things they were not intended to do for. That's the problem. It's so much problem for me. I don't like when people just push the envelope on something that was not designed for them. Why are we building TypeScript on top of JavaScript? Doesn't make any sense. If I want, is it be, again, it's my opinion. It might be that JavaScript evolved and that now we need a strongly typed language. I personally wrote for now 4 years, I'm writing JavaScript code. I never, never, ever needed a type because I know what I sign up for when I picked JavaScript. JavaScript is a great language. JavaScript. If I wanted to strongly type, I would have picked C++ or C Sharp. Why would I move to JavaScript? I moved to JavaScript because of this benefit. Now you're just building some layer on top, what's called TypeScript. That's my beef with TypeScript. Why? Why? Oh, because safety. Why are you doing it in JavaScript then? Just use another language because I like JavaScript. I can't say anything about that. Again, my opinion. Don't get pushy. Why not build website in C? Exactly, Jamesh. Exactly. Just build it in C++, like compile it in WebAssembly. Voila. This extra layer is the doom of us. People just build layers on top of layers on top of layers. Yeah, it sounds sexy because, oh, JavaScript, I don't have these errors anymore. That is awesome. Well, don't build in JavaScript if you don't want. If you're building so much complex stuff that you need to know the type, first of all, you need to code in a way so that you don't really need to know the type, right? You can know that. If you know what you're doing, you can know that. But people are just lazy, I think. You don't have C++ run on Chrome the same way JS does on, so TS makes sense. Yeah. C++ runs on Chrome and as WebAssembly, and this is getting better and better with time. But again, this is my opinion, guys. Don't let it affect you. Obviously, if you like TypeScript, I don't have anything against that. I just question why all the time. I question why, right? If there are limitations in JavaScript, they are this limitation was there for a reason. They just didn't want to do it. Now we're doing it. Why? It's just this jump. People forgot why people designed JavaScript and Python. I think that's what happened here. Exactly, wasn't. Again, guys, people use Node.js TypeScript to build backend, right? Again, yeah, you can definitely do that. That's kind of a good point, I guess. Again, I'm free to change my opinion. I can easily be persuaded to change my opinion if I know why. So this is a good point, right? So if people write JavaScript on the backend on a Node.js, and they started running building super huge app that is just was not designed for the web, then well, I still want to do Java. I'm just arguing the devil advocate here, right? So I'm building JavaScript, and I build all these beautiful classes and stuff like that. And I start being bigger and bigger and bigger, and now all of a sudden, this now becomes really, really hard to manage, right? But I really like JavaScript. Why do you like it? Because now I have to build a library once, and I can use it in Node.js. At least now with the modules MJS, I can. Michael Jackson file. I can build an MJS file in Node and then use it in the browser. I didn't see this happen. I think I built, I made a video that actually a video, a file that is a library on MJS built on Node, and I referenced it in the browser and it works. That was genius. That's a great advantage for using JavaScript. Now, if you build huge apps, then I might understand that, okay, now JavaScript has been pushed to the limit. Maybe it's time to add types. So maybe that will. I would use types if it was added natively to the JavaScript. If it, not another language. Still, I'm not convinced about this TypeScript being compiled to JavaScript. This is just an extra layer. All right. If the standard of JavaScript decided to build to use types in JavaScript, then I'm gonna use them because there was a reason for it. PLN 50, the way of dev. Hello, Hussein. I just wanted to say that I've learned a lot from you. Big thank you. Thank you so much for the super chat. I appreciate you. I'm glad that you guys are enjoying the content. I'm glad that you guys learned. This is the goal of this channel. We're having discussion, guys, and don't take it personally if I don't like a technology that you use. Again, this is you personally use something. If you find value in it, nobody's opinion actually matter, right? If you use JavaScript, definitely continue use JavaScript. I mean, at work, people that I work with use TypeScript. At my work, do not use JavaScript anymore. They only use TypeScript. And I expressed my opinion. I expressed my opinion there as well. But they all shut me down. So they say, Hussein, you don't know anything about JavaScript. Stop. which might be true, because I don't code JavaScript daily basis just like they do. Maybe there was a good reason. If my company moved to TypeScript, there was a reason for it. There's always a reason. I just might not know it yet. But yeah, if I most of the time I code in JavaScript, but it's all like tiny apps. The big apps that I build is like in C Sharp, mostly in C Sharp and VB.NET and PHP. Ooh, Golang is backend. I mean, you can write. It depends. Like, what does it mean by a Golang backend or frontend? You can write a Golang app that actually execute in a frontend and consumes a backend. Yeah, you can use it for both. Thanks for all the advice, Hussein. Thanks, Alex. Appreciate it. I started my career as a DevOps engineer, and it's been 2 years now. What is the future of DevOps? Any opinion? I talked about DevOps. It's a great field, actually. It solves a problem and it makes you think in a diverse manner, which is very useful, especially for beginners, I think. Do I see it work as a DevOps engineer for a long run? Just like the full stack engineer. I don't see that, in my opinion. I don't see it for 20 years, people working on that, because I always see that, okay, you're going to start with the DevOps engineer and then you do all of this stuff and you start gravitating to one aspect of things, which is the operation aspect or the maintenance aspect or the deployment of operating system or the Kubernetes aspects of things. And then you start diving into, and then until you zoom in into one tiny sector vertical, and then you focus your energy. You become either a backend or a frontend engineer or an edge engineer or a proxy engineer or a database engineer. That's how I see it. TypeScript is JavaScript growing up. Maybe. Python. Python is great, but I just, the only thing I hate about Python is just this tab silly thing, the tab spaces thing. Thank you for the WebRTC. Welcome. We are on topic. We are not on the topic anymore. Yeah, we're done. We talked about Hamza. We talked about quick. We're done. Well, this is just Q&A. I said I'm going to end the stream like half an hour ago, but I just, you guys asking great questions. So we're going to end this soon. Now, what's this time? Yeah, I'm going to end it at 9 o'clock PST and then in 8 minutes. So gonna end this whole show soon, guys. 5-6 more minutes. Let's take more questions and then I go have some breakfast. And you can, guys, have a great weekend. Do you recommend learning data structure and algorithms in Python? Learning is always a good idea. It depends what you're trying to do, right? Data structures and algorithms give you kind of low level understanding of different structures that you can use in order to develop something, which you're going to use it. But most of the time, you will use data structures, but not as much as algorithms, at least from my experience. You're going to use a queue. You're going to build a queue in your, you're going to build a stack. You're going to build these hash maps, right? All the time. I found data structures are more important than algorithms, because algorithms are very low level core concepts that if you're building, I don't know, a graph database, for example, you need to know how Dicastra work, right? As an algorithm, because, and you might even know you need to tweak that algorithm, right? This is just like existing algorithm, but as you code, you will build your own algorithms to build the software. You will definitely start building your own algorithms. You might take advantage of existing algorithm, but I think it depends how core your app is. If it's dependent, there's like, if it's a core layer and then there's a lot of layers on top of it, I think you're going to use algorithms a lot. If it's on the shell, like you're a proxy or you're accepting a web app request and you're serving just an endpoint, I don't think you need to learn algorithms. But Learning does not hurt, guys. So asking a question, oh, do I have to learn this? Of course. It's just like asking, oh, will this be on the test? If you don't want to learn it, then you don't have the passion to learn it, then that might not be the field for you. But it's just be curious. I don't know all the data detection algorithms, but if I want to, if I run into a problem that needs a data structure, I'm going to learn data structures. So a few knowledge will not hurt you. It's just like, hey, just have a knowledge about this. But fundamentals are most important for me. Like learn about communication protocols, which kind of touch about data structure, which kind of touch about algorithm, which kind of touch about all of that stuff. Dima, tahiyya min al-Kuwait. Greetings from Kuwait. Thank you for the $5. Appreciate you. Thank you for the super chat. Welcome to the stream. Is it a good idea to write native database queries instead of using ORM in Java? I never used the ORM, but I would always use raw database queries because I have full control. ORM kind of hides that from you, but and I don't like things that hide stuff from me. I like to understand what's going on. Master of one skill or full stack? Start with full stack and then zone in into one skill. If you're starting up, do full stack. Just taste everything. Taste this, taste this, taste front end, taste back end, taste database. And you're going to find yourself gravitating towards one, and then immediately you're going to learn it. I'm a computer science student who's decent at the back end, and I want to increase my knowledge. Should I learn DevOps or front end? DevOps, definitely DevOps. If you want to kind of spread, DevOps will give you the spread. Frontend will, it's a focus, right? I'm not saying to minimize frontend. No, frontend is a great field, and it's its own beast, right? So if you want to go frontend, you're gonna go hard in the frontend and then learn about so much stuff there. Frontends is not just React and browsers. Just look, the biggest front-end developer that I follow is the smartest one in communication protocols, and his name is Daniel Stenberg. Let me give you his Daniel, what's his name? Daniel Stenberg. This guy, you can say he's a front-end engineer, but he built curl. Do you guys know curl? C-U-R-L. He built it. And you know how complex this software is? It's everywhere. It's everywhere. It's a curl, it's a software, and there's a curl lib, which is a library, a C library, that you can reference and make calls. It's an HTTP 1.1 client. It's a TCP client. It's a UDP client. It's an HTTP 2 client. It's an HTTP 3 client. It's an MQTT client. So he is the biggest front-end engineer I know. And look at how much stuff. He's just in the front-end, right? And he always make call to a server. So technically, his front-end is a different level. I will never reach his level at any time in years, right? But he has knowledge of the back-end communication protocols because he built them. He builds libraries for them. So that's the ultimate front-end engineering to me, right? How you can be so niche into front-end engineering so that you can know this little nitty-gritty and keep adding features to this beast. FTP, thank you, actually. FTP, IMAP, everything. Everything. Curl is a Postman as a CLI. Does Postman? I thought Postman only does HTTP. And HTTP3 coming soon. POP3, look at this stuff. You have no idea how much work does he put in this library. And he fixes all the bugs. And he has security. Because once you have protocols, you have all of a sudden, you have all these bugs and security stuff. So he's well adept and knowledgeable about security issues, networking, right? Although technically you can call him a front-end engineer. I don't think he's going to like that, maybe. He doesn't identify himself as a front-end engineer, but that's what he does. Do you have your Discord, Hussein? If not, maybe you should start. Yeah, I have a Discord channel, guys. It should be in the description of every video, guys. I don't know why people keep asking me. Did I forget to add it? Let me check. I should have like my Discord. Maybe, you know what? Maybe I removed it from the default description. Oh, yeah, I removed it. Go to my main channel. There is an icon. There is Discord. The Discord icon. Yeah, maybe I should add it back. We're having great discussions there, guys, with the front-end engineering, back-end engineering, everything. There you go. That's the link. That's the link. Linkodis. DM, is it good practice to save the token inside the database for a small business? So when the user changed the password, the token will not work again. I need that because I just one user per account. I mean, nothing wrong with storing the token in the database. I mean, the database is secured by default. So, I mean, technically you have to store the token because how else would you verify it? I know people complicate things and says, oh, what about this? Sometimes you have to just take the easy route and says, okay, I'm going to use a password. I'm going to store my password as a hash. And I talked about that in the authentication video. You can store the password in many, many ways, right? Eventually, you need to store the token in the database so that you can query and make sure the token is still valid, if the token that they sent you is valid. I don't know if you're talking about JWT token or something else. All right, guys. Let's just end it here. It's 9 o'clock in the morning. And you guys, probably it's late a little bit wherever you are. I'm going to see you on the next one, guys. You guys, you stay awesome. Thank you. Thank you so much, guys. Thank you so much. Oh, stateful versus stateless. Yeah. So stateful is exactly, that's the video I made. Like, if you store it, it becomes stateful as a system. But the application is still stateless because the application doesn't store anything, right? And you can go full stateless, like a JWT, although I have my opinions about JWT. Yeah. Thank you so much, guys. Thank you for the live stream. 2 hours. Love you so much. I'm going to see you in the next one. Goodbye and have a great weekend. Appreciate you guys. And join us in the Discord and let's have some great discussions, guys. Goodbye. Stay awesome. Have a great weekend.